ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 22 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Jimmy Unwellers, Avesta Bloodstock. Joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke and our special guest, Michael Christian. Michael, or Chris-O, as many may know him as, has had an incredible life playing AFL, working in sports media, breeding champion racehorses, and working within the AFL system. Today, we'll take a dive into Chris-O's life, where his thoroughbred interest developed, and some of the success he's had across his multiple careers. Chris-O, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Good on you, Justin, and good morning, Taylor.
Mate, we'll talk a little bit about your AFL and breeding career shortly, but firstly, I know you're a Western Australian at heart. Did you have an interest in horse racing or breeding growing up at all, or were you purely footy mad?
No, look, I didn't have an interest, funnily enough, in thoroughbreds, but more in harness racing, because Dad was, the old man was the electrician at the local harness track in the southwest of Western Australia in a little town called Busselton, although it's not very little anymore, down near Margaret River. So, yeah, we used to have to go to the harness racing. There was probably 8 meetings a year, but absolutely loved it. And that was the era of Pure Steel and Satinova and some of the San Simeon, some of the greats of Australian harness racing. And so I developed an early interest in horses, but not really in thoroughbreds, but certainly that developed over time.
Did you always envisage moving away from Western Australia growing up, or were you always hoping that this state would be your forever home?
I got an opportunity to come to Victoria to play football. And it was always a dream to come to Victoria to play. And I didn't think it would last necessarily as long as it has, because I've never been back. But initially thought, yep, we'll come over for 3 years and see how we go. And then the plan was sort of to head home. But that didn't work out. So, I've been in Melbourne ever since. Moved in at the end of 1986 and have been in Melbourne ever since.
You played over 80 games in the Waffle and over 130 games for Collingwood, which included an AFL premiership in 1990. Outside of the pride you no doubt hold for your special mare, Bella Nipotina, who we'll talk about shortly, would you say that premiership and that era of your life was one of your most fondest and one of your most proudest?
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. It was, coming from the country to country Western Australia and played at East Perth Football Club and had some great times there, played 6 years there, and then had the opportunity to come over and play with Collingwood, which was a dream come true. And was, it was a great era. In 1987, my first year, I think we finished, second bottom or bottom, but there was an influx of very young players, and by 1990, we were able to be, make a grand final and win the premiership. So it was a very, very, very special time, and the dream of all young footballers growing up to play at the highest level and to play in a premiership team. So it was very, very special.
Not only did you have a magnificent AFL career, but you also worked heavily in the media post your retirement on radio and TV in the sports world. You hosted TV shows and even went on to commentate the weightlifting at the Olympics in 2007. Was there anything more you wanted to do to achieve in this space that you didn't get to do?
Oh, look, it was always a bit of a dream to broadcast football and commentate football, which I got the opportunity to do with Channel 10 for 10 years. It was a fantastic time in football, and Channel 10, and it was run by David Barham, executive producer, who was fantastic to me. And to be able to spend 10 years commentating football was great, and also worked in radio for a number of different stations. Started off with the ABC and got to Triple M, and even spent a couple of years down Geelong way with K-Rock, and it was, they were great days and really enjoyed it. But then the opportunity came along to join the AFL as the match review officer And it was a role that I was a little bit apprehensive about at the start, but it was something that I thought I could really try and add some value. And as a media person, I was always quite critical of what the people in the role did. So I thought, well, get in, and if you think you can do a better job, do it yourself. And they offered me that opportunity, and I took it, and now it's almost been 10 years in that role. So, and obviously by taking that role, I had to give up my media broadcasting, which is a little disappointing in some respects, but it's been a really fruitful journey as working with the AFL in that match review role.
No doubt during the winter it can be hard to balance both when the footy season's in full swing and you would begin mating plans for your mares at the farm. I'm sure that's quite a hectic time for you.
Yeah, it is. Although being able to just really streamline the AFL role, so it is very busy. There's no question about that. But I've got a great staff team and a great team at Longwood Thoroughbred Farm. And it means that I can, you know, I don't have to be there 24/7. I certainly spend most of my time there and do most of my AFL work from the farm. But it just allows me to be able to do that that extra role without feeling that I'm not on top of things. So yeah, we've got a great team at Longwood Thoroughbred Farm. So and you know, done an incredible job with. With all our horses, we do offer a full breeding service. So we foal down and we raise the foals and wean the foals and raise the young weanlings and yearlings and then obviously take them to sales. And we do have a lot of clients who do breed to race as well. So yeah, it's a great balance.
Being the match review officer, it's obviously a very important role within the AFL system, and essentially you're in charge of the fate of players potentially playing finals, winning brand lows and the like. All that sits with you. To me, it sounds incredibly stressful, and then, you know, we may obviously balancing the Longwood Thoroughbred Farm business, and it just sounds like a very stressful caper, but no doubt you're obviously a very well-balanced man that can do both.
Well, yeah, look, it is. It is and it isn't. I must admit, I just try and I know the rules obviously very, very well, and I just try and make the right decision, put the hand on the heart and try and do what's right and make the right decision that's fair. And look, sometimes that can be controversial. I try and stay away from social media and try and stay away from watching too much television around football and listening to too much radio around football, because otherwise it would make it even more difficult. But I just try and make the right call. And yeah, there are situations where players are wanting to play finals, and you know, the other scenario of course is Brownlow medals. But in the end, it's all about just doing what's right and making the right call. And I understand that people are passionate about their players, they're passionate about their team. So from that perspective, you know, I understand all that, and not everyone's going to agree with decisions, but just trying to make the right call and move on.
We'll get onto your breeding and racing career now, but first, I hear you were a stockbroker in the 90s, straight after your AFL career. And this might have been the kickstarter to taking your bloodstock career to the next level.
Yeah, well, I actually I'm a chartered accountant, worked with a company called KPMG when I first graduated from university. And then after spending a few years with a chartered accounting firm and getting membership to the chartered accountants, I joined a stockbroking firm and worked right through my football career with the broking firm, which was challenging in itself because, of course, in those days it was training at 5 o'clock. The only problem I had is that we finished work at the stockbroking firm at 6 o'clock. So it was always a challenge. I was always leaving early from work and arriving right on the death knell for training. So that was always a really challenging. But, yeah, look, it was... It was a really, I suppose, challenging time. But it was my colleague when I was in stockbroking that actually first introduced me to, in a serious manner, to thoroughbreds. He ran little syndicates of people from work, and I actually participated, not because I thought it would be, you know, a fruitful exercise, but I was more about fear of missing out because everyone else was involved. So I took 5% in, I think, four horses to start with in the mid-90s, and there were no superstars in that, but it really developed my interest, and it really shone from there. And had a hosted a lunch with Gay Waterhouse and got to know Gay, and that was the start of the real kickstart of where the whole interest in the thoroughbred game began.
Tell us a little bit about that experience with Gay Waterhouse. Obviously, one of the masterminds and one of the most impactful people that we've ever seen in, especially Australian racing, but just racing in general. No doubt that would have been a massive learning opportunity. I've read that you've done some sales with her and worked very tightly with her.
Yeah, look, it was it's been an amazing sort of relationship I've had with Gay. As I say, it started in the mid-90s and in fact, 1997, because one of my colleagues in the broking firm bought at a charity auction a corporate lunch with Gay, but because Gay was in Melbourne and my colleague was based in Sydney, he asked me whether I would like to host with our clients and have Gay in for lunch, which is what we did. And it was an incredible lunch. She's got such a presence and such an aura about her, and as you mentioned, just been an incredible person for racing in a really broad sense. So we had the lunch, and it's without going into too much detail, it was interesting because after the lunch, I was escorting her to the lift in the building, and just as the lift was arriving, she asked me whether I had any interest in horses. And at that point, I said, "Well, yeah, next week, Melbourne Cup Day." This was Melbourne Cup Day, 1997. I got a small share in a horse running in the two-year-old race. And she said, well, good luck. And as the lift doors closed, she asked me, what's the name of the horse? And I said, oh, Crew Blonde. So that was the Wednesday before Cup. And Cup Day came, and Crew Blonde was trained by Lee Freeman and the boys. And she managed to win the listed race. In those days, it was a two-year-old listed race on Cup Day. And so on the Wednesday morning, I got to work at 7 o'clock, and there was a fax. You guys probably can't even remember faxes, but they were used before email really came to fruition. And there was a fax on my desk at 7 a.m. the next morning after the horse won from Gay, congratulating me on the True Blonde's win. And if you're ever in Sydney, please come and see us. And yeah, so it sort of began from there. Incredible marketing and memory that she was. I didn't even think when the lift doors closed that she actually even heard the name. But not only did she hear the name, but she followed it up and communicated a week later. And I thought, wow, that's you know, marketing to its absolute best. And from that point, I was in Sydney for work and called into Tullock Lodge, and I greeted like I was a long lost friend. And from there, we really developed a close relationship. And I used to, follow her around at the sales. And after she invited me, and yeah, it was a great experience. And the very first year in Magic Millions, we purchased a horse called Royal Academy Colt. I think we paid $80,000 for him, and he turned out to be Phoenix Park, who was the first time he won the TJ Smith in Sydney, and it was the first time Gay had won the race named in honour of her father. So that was very special as well. And we had some other very, very good horses with Gay over an extended period. So that was a very, very exciting time in my racing times.
Absolutely it is. And no doubt there would have been a few things that you learnt over that period. But one thing I do want to ask, and it's probably touching on Longwood a little bit here as well, I guess when you're selling horses, whether it's Magic Millions or Inglis, Are you purely there to try and turn these horses over and, you know, make it a cycle as such? Or are you happy to keep these horses and race them if they aren't quite making their reserve? I mean, you obviously tasted plenty of success in the industry prior to selling horses at these sales. You know, there must be still a thirst to race these horses, even if you do have to keep a couple.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, one of our, and my brother's over the last 10 or 12 years become very involved in everything we do, and as so we're effectively partners in a lot, along with my wife Siobhan, who's an integral part of the whole business that we have. And one of our early goals was to basically breed and try and race the fillies and sell the colts, but it can be a tough game. So our objective, well, we couldn't quite get to that point. So what we did was took all our horses to market to sale, and if trainers were speculating and looking for people to come into horses, particularly with our fillies, then we'd oblige and stay involved in them, because that was something that we were keen to do. Our basic philosophy has been with breeding is to try and build families. So to try and find a nice family to really enhance, and that's what we've been able to do with a couple of specific families. And some of the end results of that have been, you know, Bella Nipotina and In Secret. So they're two families that we've built from, look, I won't say nothing, but we've really built into considerable families, and we continue to try and hold the fillies and mares within those families to continue the cycle generation after generation. So that's something that, we take our horses to the sale to sell, but if there is the opportunity to stay in and race, then that's something that we enjoy doing as well, and helps feed our strategy and our long-term objective is in trying to build families. And that, look, there are some fillies we retain. For example, unfortunately, we lost Bella Nipotina's dam in May last year, and her final foal is now a yearling by a trapeze artist, and we'll retain her to race, and then she'll become a broodmare post her racing career. That's the plan anyway.
Like racing, I guess breeding is full of highs and lows, and there's lots of success, but there's also lots of challenges that come with breeding. What would you say has been your biggest challenge in the breeding game?
Look, Taylor, it is, and people see, it's interesting, people see the expensive yearlings go through the ring at whether it's a Magic Millions or an English Easter sale, and you think, wow, that, you know, your cost is $100,000 and you've made $1.5 million or whatever the number is, and you think, wow, how easy is that? But it is a very, very tough industry. And when you think about the process of producing a yearling to go to sale, you've got to have a mare that goes in foal to start with and then carry that foal to full term. And then you've got the anxiousness of the foaling down process, which, you know, is a natural, obviously a natural process, but things can go wrong at that point. So that's always an anxious time. And then the foal's born, what is it confirmation like? And then you raise the foal, you know, with mum, and there's always pitfalls in terms of, you know, what foals get up to as well. And then you've got the weaning process, which you know, can be challenging as well. And then the growing out process, and once the weanling becomes a yearling, and then, you know, you've got to hope that the yearling hasn't put the foot down in the wrong spot in a paddock or turned too quickly, so that its x-rays are satisfactory. And then you get all the way to the sale, and then you've got to make sure that the horse's throat is of a level. Scoping is something that has become a much more of a focus, certainly over the last sort of 7 or 8 years. It used to be that their horses and yearlings would be scoped post-sale. And if you had a, in the old scale, if you had a grade 4 or grade 5, or the sale would be voided. But if you had a grade 1, 2 or 3, everything was fine and it was past fit. But, you know, in recent times, you've had a scenario where grade 3 horses have been frowned upon by buyers with the view that it's more likely that they will become grade 4s or grade 5s. And, yeah, it's, I think that's a really challenging part of it. Our grading system's now been changed as of the sale on the Gold Coast a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, hopefully that'll help. And research that's been done in terms of, horses' throats, hopefully it's much more palatable to buyers and people can understand a little bit more clearly about how that works. But I understand trainers have their own experiences with throats. But I suppose my point is, and I'm certainly not crying poor, but I'm just saying, you asked the question, what are the challenges? And they're plentiful. But if you can get through all that and have the right stallion and have a nice physical foal, then obviously you can do extremely well out of it.
As we spoke about, there's some challenges. There are, of course, occasionally some inconsistencies in terms of the grading of scopes and the horse's throat. Have you found that a bit of a challenge where you may have one vet grade at a 2 and another may grade at a 4?
Yeah, look, probably not that dramatic, but certainly, we've had scenarios where vets have graded a horse a 1 and then another vet will grade it a 3. They're all challenges that you've got to meet. And look, I understand it from a buying perspective. You know, you want the perfect animal. You know, you want the perfect horse that's got clean x-rays and is a grade 1 scope, and I get that. But from a vendor standpoint, yeah, it is challenging. You know, we had, in fact, a full brother to Of the Brave and a three-quarter brother to Eloping the Dam of In Secret. He was the most beautiful specimen, and he got through the yearling prep. This is a few years ago now, but he got through the yearling prep and, he couldn't have been happier. And I actually got offered $400,000 for him, pre-sale, not to take him to the sale. And I didn't accept that. And that would have been subject to a scope anyway. But we scoped him when we got to the sale, and he was a grade 4. So, we had to take him back home again. So, yeah, that was and that was after scoping a grade 1 at the start of the preparation. So we had no reason to think that anything had changed, but something had obviously happened that that caused that. So, yeah, and that was extremely disappointing to have a lovely colt and at the final hurdle, we had to take him home and not put him through the ring.
You mentioned in there as well about your star filly In Secret, and you co-bred her with Sejan Ho Stud, and we know that she went on to achieve some great things with the Godolphin team. Eloping Her Dam, you just mentioned her as well. She was a speedster on the track and she's been a magnificent mare. She's subsequently produced a $1.15 million filly, and even just a couple of weeks ago we saw the $2.3 million filly that went through the ring at Magic Millions. She's just been an absolutely wonderful mare, Eloping, that is, for you guys and Sejan Ho Stud.
Yeah, look, she has. She's just been, it's an incredible story, actually, because when I first started, we talked earlier about, racing with Gay, and when I finished my stockbroking time and before I started on the media phase of my life, I did a 2-year diploma in horse breeding at the TAFE out at Epping, which is just north of Melbourne in Victoria, and I learnt so much about the industry and so much about horses and handling horses, and it was best couple of years of my life in terms of just being able to learn So that was a real forerunner to developing some views in terms of how I wanted to go about it. And whether it was by good management or good luck, one of the stallions, and, you know, I remember him winning the 1985 Golden Slipper that I really gravitated to and formed part of the strategy, because our whole mantra is to try and, you know, breed a Golden Slipper winner. And there was no better stallion than Rory's Jester to try and start that process. So it's interesting that the two families that we've been successful in terms of breeding up have been, you know, the stars at the end of that three generations away have been In Secret and Bella Nipotina, but they all started with this desire to buy and get involved with a Rory's Jester mare. So we bought the Grand Dam of Bella Nipotina, a mare we named Bella Inez, who is out of Holbrook Lass, and Holbrook Lass is by Rory's Jester, and that was one of the reasons we purchased Bella Inez as a yearling over 20 years ago. And Bella Inez unfortunately only had one start and injured herself, but she certainly showed plenty of ability, ran in the Blue Diamond Preview, but unfortunately she only had the one start. So but we bred from her and bred Halliwell Bell, who's a Group 2 winner and multiple Group 1 plate, and Fuddleby Duddle, who's a Group 3 winner, who's the dam of Brereton. And then, unfortunately, Bella Inez died from a colic attack in the Hunter Valley when she was just 10 in foal to Fastnet Rock. But her final foal, which was Left an Orphan, was a Star Witness filly that we named Bella Orfana, which is Italian for beautiful orphan. And she too had lots of ability, but only had a handful of starts. And she had this heart condition that we couldn't press on, unfortunately. But her first foal was Bella Nipotina. So, so that's been the story there. And similarly with the In Secrets family, we saw a mare ever. A Rory's Jester mare advertised in South Australia, which we ended up securing with the help of Adrian Hancock, and paid not much, $10,000 for her. She wasn't fast, but she her second foal or first foal was Jessie's Girl, who was a four-time stakes runner-up, and very unlucky not to be a stakes winner. And then came Eloping. And as you say, Loping was a prime time stakes winner, and in those days won over $1 million, which was a lot of money. And she's been the producer of In Secret. So so we bought the Rory's Jester mare, Runaway Jessie. We bred a Loping. We took her to sale. We stayed in, you know, ownership there, half the horse. Thanks mainly to my wife Siobhan convincing me that that should be the case. So that's all credit to her. And then we were able to race a Loping, and then after she finished her racing career, Sedgen Ho bought into her, and so we've been partners with Sedgen Ho since that time. And yeah, she's produced some lovely foals, and yeah, really looking forward to the future over the next couple of years. A two-year-old called Kerber, trained by Kieran Maher, who looks to have plenty of ability. And then obviously the filly was a magnificent filly that's just been sold on the Gold Coast, that was purchased by John Sargent.
Now, we need to talk about the horse I'm sure everyone's been waiting to hear about, and that is, of course, the queen of Australian sprinting and one of my personal favourite horses, four-time Group 1 winner, Bella Nipotina. Chris, tell us the story of Bella.
Yeah, look, it's an incredible story, and you know, I touched on her origins. She's out of Bella Orfana, who had a lot of ability, but had a heart condition, so we had to retire her early. But sent her to Bella Orfana to Pride of Dubai, and I was always a massive rat for Pride of Dubai because he beat, ironically, Eloping's three-quarter brother of the Braves in the Blue Diamond of his year. And I remember looking at Potter Dubai in the mounting yard before the Blue Diamond and thinking, wow, what a specimen. And I even had a thought then that you know, if I had had an appropriate mare, that I would love to go to Pride of Dubai. And the fact that he was by a streetcar as well was an added bonus. So we sent Bellador Fauna to Pride of Dubai and produced this filly that was a lovely filly, very strong, very powerful, a bit short coupled, and but looked like a natural sprinting type. But in the early days, we didn't prep yearling, so I sent her down to my great friend Anthony Mithen down at Rosemont Stud, and the only complication was that when we loaded her on the truck ride down to Rosemont, she flipped and thrashed, and she got off the truck at Rosemont covered in cuts and blood, and it was pretty horrific actually. And at one point we wondered whether she would even get through and survive. But the Rosemont team did an incredible job. And the complicating factor, of course, was that she got through it fine. But for the first sort of 4 to 5 weeks of the prep, she was in bandages and stuck in a box without unable to do much at all. In fact, you can still see the scars on her legs from that that truck incident as a yearling. And really from there, we decided to take her to the sale. And Rosemont did an incredible job, but it was almost impossible to get her perhaps where she could have been without that accident. So at the end of it all, she sold. David Hayes bought her and asked if we would like to stay involved, which we were very keen to. And she went off and went through the Lindsay Park program. And I remember David ringing me in about September of her 2-year-old year, just saying, "Oh, look, I think this horse has got a fair bit of ability. We want to run her in the debutante stakes." And I said, "Oh, well, that's great." And so that was her very first start as an October 2-year-old in the debutante stakes. She went for an inside run, and fortunately it got shut down. So she pulled to the outside off heels and ran a very competitive fourth, and in a way probably lucky that she a bit unlucky that she didn't win that first start. And really from there, that was the start of the Bella Nipotina story. And to be able to race competitively in a stakes race at as an October 2-year-old, and to do what she did at age 7 in an Everest is just truly remarkable.
I think the best part about what you said there was, I guess, how tough she really is. As you mentioned, she was seemed to be in a little bit of trouble as a younger horse, but being a pre-Christmas 2-year-old and winning some of Australia's best races at the age of 7. She's just a truly remarkable horse, and no doubt your pride in her must be, I can't even put it into words. She's just simply a special mare.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just surreal, to be honest. Going through, she was always very competitive as a 2-year-old. In fact, she'd won $500,000 as a maiden, and then eventually won the Group 3 Quizette Stakes as an early 3-year-old. And that was even in a way accidental, because we'd run numerous times as a 2-year-old, mainly in stakes races. She got beaten the nose in the English Millennium, the $2 million race. And she'd been super competitive in all her racing. And it was interesting because it was her first run after a break. And I remember Tom Dabney ringing and saying, "Well, we've nommed her for Geelong in a maiden, and I've also thrown in a nom for the Quizette." And as it turned out, our aim was to run in the Geelong maiden, but she got balloted out. So we'd already had the acceptance for the Quizette, and she was able to get a run in the stakes race, and that's where we went, and she duly won it. At $20, which was a huge thrill for all of us, because she had been so close during her 2-year-old racing career to winning a stakes race, but she had finally done it. So Yeah, look, it's and to really come from there, and of course at the end of her three-year-old career, Kieran Maher made an offer to buy the horse. We were never going to sell her, but he ended up buying out the other 50% of the horse. David's clients, and from there, as part of that, obviously the horse had to move to Kieran's stable, and again, you know, during that early part with Kieran, you know, she was very competitive without being a star, but you know, to think that she was able to race on and do what she did. In fact, it was quite interesting. In June 2023, we all had a meeting. Ownership group had a meeting with Kieran about whether we should retire her and send her to stud in 2024, and you know, we were all keen, you know, to race on. His Kieran thought it was an idea, but he was very strong to say, look, I think there's more to give here. She's well, she's healthy, she's sound, so let's press on for another year. And of course, that resulted in some success, but it really was Queensland in May and June of last year, where she just went to a new level and winning the Doomben 10,000, beating the best sprinter in the land at the time, I Wish I Win, and then winning the Tats Tiara, you know, in dominant fashion. And, you know, there wasn't any decision then. Our goal was not to breed, was to try and win the Everest. And or we had four offers to run in from slot holders to run in the slot. We chose Tab and developed a great relationship with Tab, and of course the rest is history. Couple of unlucky lead up races where she ran really, really well, but to win the Everest from the widest gate, caught three wide, no cover, was just an incredible performance. And then to even back that up 2 weeks later to probably her most dominant victory in the Russell Baldings, beating, you know, some quality horses like Sunshine in Paris and Private Eye, etc. Yeah, it was just an incredible time for our family, and to have we're just very blessed to be associated with her. So yeah, look, it was a very surreal time.
That Everest win, I guess you mentioned there, she'd always been competitive around the mark. She'd beaten some of Australia's best, but she probably wasn't rated as Australia's best sprinter. But when she crossed the line in that Everest, that proved to every single person in Australia that this mare is Australia's best sprinter. Was that, I guess, did that run through your head at all? Was there a sense of satisfaction that she's about to get every bit of credit that she deserves?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Like, I don't worry too much about, you know, outside influence. I know some owners, you know, when horses get criticised or don't get credit they deserve, that, you know, they can be quite vocal. I'm not in that sort of realm. But it was, you know, there's a couple of moments that I felt really proud. One was the Tats Tiara, where she started pretty much odds on, and there was a huge expectation that she would win the Tats Tiara. And the way she did that was, you know, she won in dominant fashion, and I was just really pleased for, you know, I was pleased for her, but also pleased for everyone that, you know, had backed her into even money or odds on to, you know, for them to benefit from winning the race. And, you know, that was a really nice moment. And I suppose, you know, the Everest, you know, when we think about, you know, there was obviously the best sprinters in the land in the race, but moreover, to think that she did it from the widest gates, to think that she did it when she was, you know, three wide, no cover, which you know, was my worst nightmare. After she drew the wide gate, our plan was to go forward and try and sit outside the leader, which we thought might be Lady Gage's horse, Lady Camelot. But that didn't play out, and she was caught three wide. And to be able to then just keep surging and win the race, I don't think there was any doubt in anyone's mind that, you know, at that moment she was the best in the land. And then again, so back that up 2 weeks later at, you know, I think she was just over even money in the Russell boarding, but to win that in dominant fashion, I think just reinforced the view that at that time she was the best, which was incredibly gratifying and, extraordinarily proud that, you know, we bred her mum and, as well, and to be able to sort of go through the generations and be part of that is, it's very, very special.
No doubt there's hundreds of untold stories as well across your life, but from everything you've achieved in your career, from breeding to racing to playing AFL to just your media career, absolutely everything you've done in your life, it's a story that not many would be able to tell. By chance, are we ever going to see something like a little autobiography come out or some sort of documentary? Because it's certainly one hell of a story to publicise.
I don't think... No, we need to sell more than 5 copies, Justin. I've been very lucky and had a wonderful upbringing. Have been able to, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've just gone through different phases of my life. You know, from the chartered accounting phase, the stockbreaking phase, and then through all that was the football phase and then the media phase and then it's been working with the AFL and then over the last sort of 30 years it's been starting racing from an involvement in the thoroughbred industry from nothing to being where we are today. And you know, I've had so much help and support across the time, and we talked about Gay earlier, but probably the biggest influence on my entire interest in thoroughbred racing and breeding is Peter Morgan, who I ended up on his recommendation actually bought a little property right next to where he trained in Whittlesea. That's going back 20 years, and but his support and help over the time has just been amazing. So I've got to thank him a lot in terms of where we are today. He, of course, trained a loping and also trained the best stallion in the land, I'm Invincible. So it's been a really gratifying story for him with two horses that he trains, I'm Invincible and a loping, you know, producing in secret for Godolphin. So, it's been a remarkable journey. And did I ever think it would result in, you know, the pinnacle of, you know, an in secret winning two of the best group ones there are in the land of Coolmore and the Newmarket and capped by Bella Nipotina winning the Everest. You just would never have imagined that was possible. But I've been, as I said earlier, been very blessed and lucky and had great support with Siobhan and my brother Brad and people like Peter Morgan and lots of others along the way. It's just been one hell of a ride.
Absolutely. It's something that people can only dream of. But we'll just finish up now with a little segment, our Fast Five. It's just 5 quick fire questions that you can answer off the top of your head. Justin, did you want to kick us off?
I sure will. Chriso, who was the hardest centre-half forward you had to play on while you were at Collingwood?
Dermot Brereton.
What was one thing on your bucket list that you're yet to do, whether it be racing, bloodstock or just life in general?
Go to the US Masters at Augusta.
Do you prefer the breeding season or the sales season?
Probably the sales season, because it's the culmination of the breeding season, much, much more.
What is one piece of advice you would give to someone looking to send a mare to a stallion for the first time?
The one bit of advice would be to make sure that your mare is a physical match to the stallion that you're sending the mare to. I think there's lots of talk about breeding and getting that right, pedigrees and getting pedigrees right, and I think that's absolutely important. But I think it's also equally important to make sure you physically match your mare with the stallion.
Now, I'm sure you probably won't be able to answer it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Who is in the discussion to be the lucky stallion to get a date with Bella Nipotina come the end of her racing career?
Yes, well, that's a good question. I think, you know, there's obviously some great stallions around, and you know, I'm Invincible and Schnitzel have been in incredible horses, but they're now getting on in age, and who knows, Bella might be still racing in 2 years' time. No, I'm only joking. Look, that'll be a decision for the time, but we'll leave no stone unturned as to going to who we think's the best physical match and best pedigree and the most commercial. So that'll be a decision in time that'll be made.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on and joining us. We wish you the absolute best of luck for the remainder of the sales season, for the remainder of Bella's career, and for whatever comes after that as well, mate. We appreciate you coming on, and wish you good luck going forward.
No worries. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Taylor.